Welcome to The Swing, Canadian political analysis for a global audience.
I'm Malcolm Devlin, and I am delighted today to join with two of the great experts on defense and security in Canada, Alexander Lanoshka and Richard Shimuka. Alexander is associate professor at University of Waterloo and one of the leading experts on military alliances in Canada. And Richard is a contributing author to The Hub and a senior fellow with the McDonald Laurier Institute, the leading expert on defense policy, defense industry, and procurement here in Canada. So I'm very pleased to join both of you guys here to talk about this interesting week that is coming up, both the NATO summit and the signing of a Canada-EU Strategic Defense Pact agreement and whatever that is. Today, we're going to talk about that. So thanks for coming.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So let's straight jump in into this. Alexander, let me maybe start with you. Just when you look at, so we're recording on Monday, June 23rd, June 24th and 25th, NATO allies are meeting in The Hague for the summit. It's going to be a shorter summit this time. And the talk is all about initially on increasing defense spending. The numbers are that seems to be floating around is 5% in total, but the breakout is a little different. And of course, Russia's ongoing war against Ukraine and now the intensifying conflict in the Middle East will probably continue to overshadow these discussions. When you look at the summit, what can we expect? What's the central themes that we will discuss? And maybe start sort of, and I'll switch to Richard in a minute on this, to get down a little bit and unpack the 5% debate and what we can expect. But first, what do you expect from the summit Tuesday and Wednesday, and what are the central issues that the allies will be talking about?
Sure. So in general, I have very low expectations about this particular summit, and really every summit that will be taking place over the course of the next 3 years before 2029, in part because so much of the summitry will focus on keeping one person happy, and that person, of course, being the president of the United States. A key issue that he has raised repeatedly, and quite honestly, justifiably, is the level of defense spending across the alliance. It has struggled to meet the 2% threshold on the part of many countries since 2014, when that pledge was first made amongst the alliance membership in the Wales summit. Many countries do hit that bar at present, but Canada is only starting to mobilize the resources towards that end, with Prime Minister Mark Carney promising to hit 2% by March, presumably 2026. The focus of discussion will be on the 5% threshold, which obviously is a moving target for Canada. Richard can say a little bit more about how it's going to break down, but already we have seen some discussion of the carve-out that Spain had negotiated at the very last minute. Spain is peculiar because presumably other European countries could have done the same thing. And indeed, the Slovakian government has signaled its intent not to spend much more than 2% in the foreseeable future. They did not seek such an exemption. Why did Spain do such a thing? I'm not an expert on Spanish domestic politics by any means, but from what I understand, Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has been embattled due to a number of political scandals involving members of his inner circle. And so he's trying to keep members of his coalition happy. Some are in fact expecting his government to fall by the end of the summer. So by taking off defense spending from the table, then he might buy himself a little more time. Not sure how valid this explanation is, but it does seem that these immediate political considerations facing the Spanish Prime Minister have impacted already the summit. But apart from that, I think most members are going to be trying to keep the one person happy, and they're going to be agreeing to things. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily good news for Ukraine, because after all, the United States under this current administration has been reluctant to speak openly in support of Ukraine or be critical of Russia. And so we know already that Volodymyr Zelensky will not be on the main agenda of the Alliance Summit. So again, all things considered, I just do not have low expectations. Expect some pledges here and there. Expect a wired down communique. You already mentioned that's going to be a shorter meeting than usual. Maybe that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, it looks like at this stage, any multilateral meeting that ends up without having a blow up that involves Donald Trump seems to be a good thing. So people try to keep it a little short on this. I want to get back to the agenda in a minute and see whether there is. I mean, in the past few summits, we had IP4 coming in. It's not clear what the role this time they will play. It's not clear whether China will actually have any sort of part in the communique that will be coming out, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there is an interesting set of developments there that we might want to look into it. And the Spanish example reminds, again, I think for everyone, that all politics are local fundamentally. And that kind of shows up. Richard, so 5%. Supposedly the allies would agree on. How does that break down? What do you see? Is this more of a headline number, but the practicalities will not necessarily approximate to that? Or how does that work? What's the breakdown there?
Yeah, so basically 5% is a headline. It's really, it looks flashy, right? I think it gets Trump's attention, but it doesn't really translate in the same sort of way. But if we look back at the Wales Summit Pledge of 2%, that was really, really only covered core defense. And a lot of the member states, they played around with some accounting, putting some pensions, or in some cases, putting their national police services as part of it, right? And so the new target that's, you know, the framework has been announced for at 5% is really, it's trying to separate parts of those out, but it's also pretty simple agreement to in some ways. So think about core defense at 2%. It's now going to go to 3.5%. A lot of countries have sort of discussed this. The United Kingdom's looking to hit 3% based on the review they just undertaken, and they're doing a fiscal analysis to see if they can reach that point. A lot of other states are coming close to that, but other ones are going to have issues to do so. We're also thinking about sort of the economic challenges within Europe. We've already had high stimulus spending. Demographics aren't great in the coming years to sort of pay off a lot of debts. And that's part of the reason why Rearm Europe, or I can't remember the name of the other, it's other name, the
Readiness 2030.
That's it. So
because the Spanish prime minister and the Italian prime minister said that Rearm Europe was too provocative for their local publics.
And we're supposed to believe that they're going to rearm when they cannot even use the word. But anyways.
Precisely. So part of the reason why that exists is because of the fiscal stability pact. They cannot borrow too much, and this allows them to spend to that target. So anyways, going to say, so it goes to 3.5%. And then on top of that is a 1.5% defense-related spending, which right now could be an entire grab bag of whether it be dual use industries that potentially could have defense spending to it, could infrastructure spending. So even airports in Northern Canada would likely qualify, all manner of sort of spending, you know, national police forces, as we sort of mentioned before. So it hives off some of that to sort of create a more, the thought was to try to create a cleaner break. But the reality is that the target is apparently supposed to be reached by 2035 with a mechanism in 2029 to review it. I have a sneaky suspicion after the end of Donald Trump's second term, a lot of countries are going to say, well, this is just unaffordable. We're never going to reach 3.5%, and we don't really want to spend 1.5% of GDP on stuff that we don't really need. We're just going to shelve that quietly and with a new administration in the United States and new governments and walk away from that target. So, it's kind of surprising. Alex made the point about the domestic policies in Spain. I think a lot of sort of a nice veneer on these pledges, with a full intention to knowing that in about 4 or 5 years' time, their government or the next government is going to be like, yeah, we're not going to do that.
Just so I can add on to that, the United States does not spend 5% either. And Trump himself had signaled that the United States will not meet that particular target. So we can pick on Spain as much as we would like, but when the leader of the alliance purportedly is already signaling its lack of commitment, then it's not going to be treated too seriously by at least a good number of countries. There will be countries that will treat this matter very seriously because of their vulnerabilities and proximity to Russia, but outside of eastern flank countries, then that seriousness is going to attenuate.
Of funding going to Ukraine will cover for this. So I think a lot of that, you'll see a lot of countries sort of, as Canada just has, sort of top up their defense spending by claiming the funding to Ukraine is part of this, and that will come for the coming years here. You know, obviously we don't know how it's going to turn out, but I mean, that's going to be a major area of sort of spending going forward as well.
I think that this is very, you know, useful to understand that there is this aspirational number which may or may not go there, and a lot of different things can be counted towards it. And it is part of it is, of course, political dynamics, and particularly ensuring that the United States, or at least the Trump administration, is somehow kept involved and not necessarily sort of too upset about the developments. The other component, that I don't want to get into too much the weeds here, but I remember, you know, hearing in a couple of different podcasts and other places where the linkage between 3.5% and the regional defense plans, basically that if the capabilities that are identified to fulfill those regional defense plans in NATO, if the countries were to get those capability levels, that gender roughly suggests that 3 to 3.5% of spending coming forward. So the number doesn't necessarily seem to be too out of the blue, or is that just a coincidence?
I would argue that in a lot of cases, that's probably where they are, where it's required. I think Canada's basically one of the sort of faces of that problem. You've seen the lack of spending, you know, hitting 1% basically a decade ago. The amount of sort of capabilities that we put forward, given them the investment that we put into defense, is shockingly low. And the requirement to, we do have major programs that are going to be implemented in the next 5 years. You know, class destroyer, have the ongoing F-35 upgrade or a purchase, P-8s, submarines, major capability modernization programs that are going to take the vast amount of that spending and bump it up pretty significantly. So it's going to be a little bit easier for Canada because we've already sort of budgeted beyond 2%, maybe up to 2.5, right? So, and there's possibility that through these major channels of procurement or these programs of record that already have staff attached to them, you already have people that the identified personnel that are going to go into these programs, you can kind of broaden this out, get more capability, because that's the easiest way to do so. So the amounts going to 3 or 3.5% for Canada and other countries reflect, I think, some of these modernization programs that are going to have that are already ongoing and sort of building out even further.
Alexander, anything to add on this point? Oh, okay. So before jumping into the sort of the second thing with Mark Carney and meeting with the European leaders to sign on to this broader Canada-EU defense, strategic defense pact, one last thing about the NATO summit, and that is, as I mentioned in the beginning, in the Pacific Four, the four countries that have been invited to the summits in the past few years. This is South Korea, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand. Do you see their role in this particular summit to be a bit more diminished? We didn't really have any, you know, mention of China, you know, for example, with the G7 communique, that was not really a communique, but statements that were coming out. In the previous years, G7, China was mentioned 29 times. This time, I think it was once in the chair's summary. Do you see sort of the role or concerns about China that seem to play an important role in the last two summits was sort of disappear and not really mentioned? How do you see that particular development? Alexander, maybe I'll start with you, and then if Richard has anything to add, I'll go there.
I don't have specific thoughts on this particular question, aside from how it's very easy to overstate the importance that those countries attach to NATO. You and I, Balkan, have been to Tokyo not that long ago, and one thing that we sensed immediately was that there is some hesitation involved with expanding linkages. And what we've heard from various conferences that we've attended is that members or delegates from those countries have said that they don't necessarily want to have military linkages forged, which is odd because NATO, after all, is a military alliance. It's not difficult to see why. They have their own considerations, very local to them. They understand that NATO is a consensus-based alliance, and we see firsthand right now that there is no consensus on Ukraine, let alone issues relating to China. So of course they're going to be somewhat reluctant to expand way more than what NATO could possibly accommodate. I think they know that. I think they're mature enough to realize it. So I'm not sure I would use the word diminish, because their stature vis-a-vis the alliance was already fairly limited, even though they're, of course, official partners to the alliance. But I think just the reality leaves them in a very circumscribed role as ever.
Yep. Richard?
Yeah, so two parts. I agree with that, Alex, and I think that's part of the issue. I think even within the alliance, there's a real hesitant. We know that the French have been pretty... They want some level, but they put basically the stops on any sort of formality to the summit, and I worked out from memory. I don't think the South Korean president is going. Some of the core Asian members are not showing up. So, not members, to the Asian partners. The other side of it is a practical point: is that we're recording this. We're waiting potentially an Iranian response. I mean, part of that agenda is going to be taken up by dealing with the follow-up for this, whether it be in the main session or on a sidebar. And that's going to take some of the oxygen, especially with a shorter conference like this. It's going to, I think, push discussions of China or any sort of Pacific issues basically to the back burner, especially if I can see a lot of the Eastern European countries really want to get the discussion on Ukraine or spending on defense alliance there. So in order to fit all of this stuff in, I think China's not going to get much play because of it's being seen as a secondary.
Absolutely. Alexander?
Yeah. I'll just add to that by saying that, in fact, at this moment, the United States wants Chinese cooperation. China receives a lot of oil from Iran, and if Iran were to close the Strait of Hormuz, as what might be the case in response to the U.S. bombing of their nuclear facility this past weekend, then that's going to have tremendous implications for China. And so we've already seen Secretary of State Marco Rubio ask China to put pressure on Iran not to close the Strait of Hormuz. So I don't see anything at this particular summit that would be unnecessarily antagonistic to China as such.
No, absolutely. And I think there is a possibility, depending on the Iranian reaction, that Donald Trump might actually cut the trip short as well, just like he did with G7 and head back to Washington. I don't think people will necessarily mind that.
To be honest.
No, exactly.
It's the perfect not at excuse. All. He's just like, yes. He's used it once before. He's like, well, I got more important things to do. Fine.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, they already planned a short summit. So I don't think many people will be particularly upset if there is less opportunity for a fight to come out to it. But so we'll see. But you know, I completely agree that the developments in the Middle East will be the big shadow over the summit. In the last couple of minutes, just want to briefly touch on from the Canadian side, the importance, or to what degree we need to attach importance to Prime Minister Carney's announcements are coming up today, and a signing of a declaration of intent, a high level strategic document, as it is generally described as, between EU and Canada in terms of cooperation on strategic cooperation on defense related issues. We have a set of ideas about this, and we wrote about this before in terms of we need to calibrate the expectations about what this could mean for Canada and Canadian defense industry and capabilities. But what's your take on this signing of this particular, I would say even a letter of intent, a memorandum, what it looks like, we'll see the details of it. But how important it is, and what's the sort of the balance between the practicalities of it that will probably be worked out later down the road versus the political symbolism that the Prime Minister seems to be attaching to it. Alexander, let me start with you, and then I'll end up with Richard.
Sure. Just as a sidebar, Iran has recently launched missiles at U.S. Airfields in Qatar and Iraq. So it's very possible that Trump will not attend the meeting at The Hague. But to answer your question, listen, I'm not ever going to be one in favor of not expanding ties with Europe and making linkages with European defense industry. Certainly, I think more resilient supply chains, greater diversification and so forth are ipso facto good. That being said, I think we just have to be realistic about what can be achieved by expanding cooperation with Europe. So I think a key signature of any sort of new defense partnership with the European Union would involve Canada being a party to Rearm Europe. Rearm Europe is something that Prime Minister Mark Carney has mentioned. He has said that on this very date, the 23rd of June, could be the very date that Canada joins this initiative. There has not actually been much discussed within the Canadian national security discourse, from what I've seen, on what Rearm Europe really is. So perhaps it does behoove us to just spend a minute to talk about it. But basically, it is a strategic defense initiative announced by the European Commission earlier this year. It was supposed to be called Rearm Europe. Now it's called Rearm Europe / Readiness 2030. And Richard already mentioned that there have been a number of demographic and fiscal challenges facing European governments across the continent. They have limits as to what they can do in terms of deficit spending. Rearm Europe serves to bypass some of those limits by helping to mobilize upwards of 800 billion euros, or 1.2 trillion Canadian dollars, over the course of the next 5 years by way of loans that would have the duration of 45 years, so effectively intergenerational debt. And the stated purpose of Rearm Europe is to facilitate more joint procurement and cooperation in a continental environment racked by a fragmented defense industry. And yet, I think it is fair to say that as much as that might be the stated purpose of Rearm Europe, the fact of the matter is that the European defense industry will remain fragmented as such. The Rearm Europe initiative does not actually address some of the more systemic or structural problems that have attended the European defense industry. It is effectively throwing money at the problem. Moreover, if you look at the rules for how the money ought to be spent, 65% of consumables like munitions or complex systems like aircraft all have to be produced or be under the effective control of EU member states. Again, that leaves a very small percentage for Canada. If it were to involve itself in any sort of joint projects, despite all the push for joint procurement over the course of the last 15 years, there has been only a modest increase from about 11% in 2010 to about 18% in 2021, short of the 35% goal made by the European Commission. It's not hard to see why. Different countries have their own requirements, their own design philosophies, their own domestic industrial needs. And indeed, so many of these countries within Europe see defense not necessarily as a means for generating military power against a military threat, but as a means to go about industrial policy and ensure a certain percentage of the workforce is in manufacturing. It'll be very difficult for Canada to get too much of a stake in it. It's really a European solution to a European problem, and an imperfect one at best. And so I think Canadians should be very tempered in the expectations that they can have for this particular initiative. It's not going to solve Canada's under spending problems. It's not going to necessarily address capability cap gaps. But again, it could be useful for certain things like financing certain needs that the Canadian military deployment in Latvia, for example, could have, precisely because the supply lines would be shorter. It is Europe after all. It might not necessarily be important for, or rather pertinent for, issues relating to North American defense, which is indeed what Canada does and what European NATO countries do not do.
No, absolutely. And Richard, I want to turn to you for the last word on this, but just want to highlight one thing that, you know, Canadian politicians always talk about, you know, Canadian jobs and Canadian businesses and doing it in Canada. And therefore, they shouldn't be surprised to see that the Europeans will be saying the same thing in this particular case. So I completely agree with the tempering the expectations of part of it. But Richard, I want to turn to you. You highlighted in a recent roundtable the importance of basically having shorter supply chains and buying things on with the partners, or producing things with the partners that are relevant for the places that they will be used when it comes to Canadian defense procurement. And as Alexander pointed out, when it comes to army and related needs, European defense cooperation and working with European countries make sense, but not so much when it comes to naval or air assets. What's your sort of your brief take on the rearm / readiness Europe and the supposed sort of the high level agreement that Carney is going to sign and the expectations on that?
I'll be even more direct than Alex. I think that is completely misstating what is the focus of this program. I think that clearly Carney and others have kind of tried to portray it as some sort of great reorientation of our industries or efforts, and it just can't do that. It is not designed that. And one of the core aspects of it is that it is just reinforcing a lot of the worst tendencies of European defense industry by basically pouring in money into the same old companies, right? A big factor behind this is basically France's push to sort of maintain its national champions like Dassault and like others in order to gain them orders. We just saw last week at the Paris Air Show, Airbus and Germany come to Airbus and Dassault may fracture their future combat air system, their next generation fighter program, because they can't agree on work share, right? And this is the programs that we are looking at to sort of join and pour, you know, be part of Rearm Europe, put money into. And this program doesn't, or the Rearm effort doesn't really address that, as Alex says, right? So that's a real challenge. Now,
and aerospace is actually one of the more Europeanized areas of European defense too.
Oh, absolutely. But anywhere you look in their industry, this is one of the most highly protectionist, sort of almost like a defense autarky, right? That they want to protect these national champions to do so. And when it comes to real military capability, if you're watching what's going on in the US, there's some really negative things that are going on with their defense industries and their defense administration because of the Hegseth as Secretary of Defense and what's going on there. But overall, you are watching them look at what are the future technologies, what's going to work, and make real big bets on, well, we see that, you know, drones and all that are working really effectively in Ukraine. How do we address that? You know, what air defense systems do we need to go after this threat? Whereas a lot of this funding that we're seeing in Europe are going to likely go down the same current path. It's not going to be super innovative in a lot of cases. It'll take a lot of time to get these programs through. So we're not talking about something that's going to be delivered in 2028, 29, 30. It's something like maybe 32, 35, right? Well beyond where it's actually useful, and we're watching what's going on in Ukraine or the window of vulnerability, as they say in Taiwan and China, right? So those time horizons, it's a real challenge. And so when you hear this idea that, oh, well, this is going to be our, basically it's one of his only major stated efforts to reorient Canada outside of its current sort of defense industrial architecture, it's not a great strategy at all. The outcome of this is likely only going to help with just maintaining or slightly expanding our market access to Europe or preserving what we have, and not really foster a much larger, because again, it's a protectionist architecture that's not going to get changed whatsoever.
No, I mean, I think we need to have a dedicated session to discuss all these details, because as Alexander pointed out, I don't think many people are aware of the nature and the purpose of this particular program and how that actually overlaps or not with the Canadian needs and expectations, as well as the way in which the Europeans will be engaging with that. Yes,
I mean, for goodness sake, it's called Rearm Europe.
Rearm Europe.
Right? Even that name was problematic. So it's neither Rearm nor Europe.
Nor Europe.
But it's definitely not called Rearm North Atlantic, not even called anything that might in fact encompass Canada. So I think, the name itself indicates some of the challenges that Canadian participation would face.
No, absolutely.
And I'll say this, Bog, to your point, Dwight, I think very few people actually studied how European defense markets work, right? Because it's never been an attractive place for Canadian defense manufacturers. We have far, far more trade with the United States because of our defense production sharing, because we can operate as sort of subcontracts to US firms without having any sort of discussion on work share. It's best value contract. But in Canada, there's just, there's an overall view that these are just fungible, right? One can be traded with another and they're all the same, and they are not. Anybody who has studied this in any sort of fashion will understand that these are different markets with different objectives to some degree, whereas Americans care about capabilities. They care about what your output is, whereas Europeans are like, well, we have other goals in mind, right? We got to make sure that we keep these industries ostensibly for, maintaining a defense industrial base for future capacity. Although looking at the outcomes now when they are spending and how slow it's been for them to regenerate their capabilities, it seems more now it's like, no, we got to make sure that the unions in Germany are getting enough contracts so that we get their support. And so that's a real challenge. And I don't think those dynamics are at all understood in Canada. It's not an area of study whatsoever.
No, we definitely need to come back to this at another podcast episode. But I think we'll end up here. Once again, thanks for joining me, and looking forward to do this again in the future.